Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And we're going to start today's program off with an interview, a little discussion we had with one of today's most charismatic chefs, Graham Elliott, who not only is a celebrated TV personality, but he also is a great cook and a great teacher, which he expresses in his latest book, Cooking Like a Master Chef.
Yeah, I mentioned to him during our discussion that he seems like he has a healthy disrespect for culinary awards, but yet his restaurant in Chicago still has 2 Michelin stars.
Yes.
So clearly this man knows a lot, and you're going to enjoy listening to him, not just learning about what he knows, but listening to him because he's a really fine fellow.
Graham Elliott, you probably don't know it, but I have admired you from afar for a long time.
Wow, thank you.
This book, your very first book, is called Cooking Like a Master Chef, 100 Recipes to Make the Everyday Extraordinary, and in fact does do that. A little background, you are, of course, a chef, a restaurateur, a big-time TV personality as of Master Chef Junior, and you're launching a new show. When is it, spring?
Yes, exactly. We did a couple episodes, 6 episodes on the Food Network called Craziest Restaurants in America, which was really exciting. So might see a continuation of that. And then we're filming the next season of Master Chef and Master Chef Junior at the beginning of the year.
Wow. So do you spend a lot of time in California then?
I do. You know, I have one restaurant now in Chicago, and that's where I live and my family is and everything else. But I spend the first probably 12 weeks or so in California filming MasterChef.
Yeah, well, I saw you at the Nashville Music City Food and Wine Festival,
mm-hmm.
and I said I stalked you all over the place, but couldn't get near you. I even told one of your handlers that I wanted to talk to you because I knew I was going to be interviewing you. But you were just surrounded by adoring fans. As you said, this is not just celebrity chef stuff. This is TV personality big time.
Absolutely. I mean, there's more chefs that work in kitchens, you know, that are funny and engaging and just great to be around than almost any other kind of line of work. I mean, you know that. You know, even radio, just any kind of media. And what happens is as soon as you put, like, a TV camera on somebody and 7 million people get to see you every week, they feel like they know you. And I think that's always been something with me because I traveled all around the world and been to all 50 states because my dad was in the Navy. I get along with people really well and come across as, I guess, pretty genuine because, you know, what you see is what you get. And I think that makes it fun and easy for people to come up and just kind of chat.
Yeah, and people get this feeling through this book. I mean, your recipes and so on. I might mention that you were also an accomplished musician. Voice and guitar, is it?
Yeah. I didn't play guitar. I used to be in a band and still kind of play stuff on my own, record my own music and play it at the restaurant and stuff like that, because I feel a restaurant needs to be an extension of you, and even if I only know how to do a couple things, I want to be able to showcase some of it. So, you know, I think there's a great synergy and relationship between food and music. You know, all chefs are failed rock stars, and all rock stars want to be chefs. So it goes hand in hand.
Now, I read something that said that you could tell your rock and roll roots from some of these recipes. I'm not sure. Could you point out something that proves this?
It's the buffalo chicken, you know. We do our own boneless chicken thigh because it's dark meat. It's, you know, richer. We crisp it up, glaze it in our own buffalo sauce, and then serve it with some beer bubbles and some roasted cream. And yeah, so we froth up some beer and spoon it over the top and do a little celery slaw. So it's the same dish, cheese and celery and wings that you've had with a beer, but kind of all incorporated in one to make it a little quirky.
Now, please tell me you don't say bam all the time.
Oh, no, I have no catchphrases. Nothing like that.
Thank goodness. I love the white glasses.
Yeah, those have kind of become the signature. But what's fun is it's like the the Clark Kent thing, where if I'm out with my kids and take them off, no one knows who I am.
Yeah, the funny part about it is years ago I was traveling on a week-long business trip, and I forgot my glasses, without which I'm totally blind. So I went to the drugstore in the airport and bought a pair of standard magnifiers.
Mm-hmm.
And they were white plastic.
Oh, wow.
And I had to wear white plastic magnifiers for a whole week. And many of the people that I met on that trip still remember.
Did they come up to you and ask how Gordon Ramsay was? Did they think that you were me?
No, they didn't think they were me. They knew I was me, but they also knew that the white glasses would not ordinarily have been my style, shall we put it that way?
Yeah. Well, that's the number one question I get is how is Gordon? Is he really like how he is on TV? That's what people always want to know.
You know, he's one person we've never interviewed. I have no idea why. I guess he's very busy. I never even thought to interview him.
We met some people who met him. You remember those Chinese chefs from Manchester?
She was two young women, Chinese chefs from Manchester, England, that had all kinds of diplomatic connections and whatever. And Gordon Ramsay boosted them up. He identified them as potential proteges and did something for them. I can't remember what.
They were on his show. And the interesting thing was they said he was really nice.
Yeah, he definitely is. He's like the hardest working person I've ever met.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah,
like,
he's
so focused.
They said he doesn't curse one little bit. He's really really a real gentleman.
Yeah, and he's also got the greatest sense of humor ever.
Well, so do you.
Fun to be around.
I mean, that's part of the fun of this book is that your sense of humor comes through.
Good.
Yeah. You have a manifesto. Tell us about your manifesto.
I was always lucky that I knew what I wanted to do at an early age. And so I had my first, chef job at 23. And right around that time, kind of wrote down this manic fit of energy, probably 2 in the morning, just this list of things that I kind of like cook and live by. And it turned into my manifesto of sorts. And I've had it now for 12 years, I guess, and look back on it with Mary, and I was just like, pretty much the exact same thing that I do now. So we decided to throw it in there.
Yeah, that's good.
Let's everybody share it. It's long.
Yeah, you can't.
Oh, you can't?
Long.
Can't say.
It goes on for 2 years.
Oh, can't condense it. Okay.
No.
You have to buy the book to read the manifesto, to understand the manifesto.
Yeah, your kids are adorable, by the way. They're very cute.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, and they're chefs and food critics in the making, I understand.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They're into it.
Now, you have all of your recipes, I think, show a kind of what we said before, your quirky spirit.
Mm-hmm.
But they have an out of the ordinary flair to them.
Yeah, I think so. I think what's great though is that for the most part, they're dishes that you have seen or had, whether at a restaurant or even at your mom's house, the stroganoff, the pot roast, the pork chop with apples and potatoes. But here, we do them all different. So it's braised short rib, mushroom puree, spätzle, and peppered creme fraiche. That's your stroganoff. Either Focus is a giant brioche Twinkie filled with Parmesan mascarpone. But, if you close your eyes and taste it, it's still a Caesar salad. It's just, putting in it a new spin to make it fun.
Now, that's your signature dish, the Caesar
salad. Yeah.
I think somewhere in the manifesto, it must say I have a healthy respect for the status quo, a disrespect for the status quo.
Yeah, I think I say if it's not broken, break it. You should always change for change's sake, because you never want to get stagnant. So I've always been anti-signature dish, but I kind of go back and forth, because I think if you went and saw the Rolling Stones, you want to hear Ruby Tuesday, and you don't want the band to say, well, we're tired of it, we don't want to sing it, because that's one that people like. So the fact that someone will come to my restaurant and want to give me money to taste something that they know is good, it's kind of silly for me to say, no, I don't want to, because I don't feel like it. So I guess it's like a wine, you mature as you keep doing this. If I start at 20 and it's like it's just all about me and, the customer better understand what I do because I'm such an artist. I think by the time you're in your 30s, you kind of realize that that's a bit selfish.
And that, what is this whole big thing you have on marshmallows?
I love marshmallows. I think something that as a kid you enjoy. And so what we do, it's just a way to transfer the flavor in a more visual way. So we'll make our marshmallows, but if you're doing a pea soup, it can maybe be lavender or mint. If you're, you know, you could do curry. But when you melt your sugar and kind of make your base for the marshmallow, I infuse it with different things. So, yeah, you can do cinnamon or chives. And then when you serve the dish, you serve the garnish and the soup on the side and then pour it in front of your guest, and it melts the marshmallow. So when you stir it, it infuses the soup with some of those flavors.
Yeah. Now, I've been talking to you about some of my favorite things out of your book. How about giving us some of your favorite recipes?
You know, I love the Kung Pao drumsticks because I love, you know, Kung Pao chicken, and I think that's something that is really fun. I love the cantaloupe gazpacho just because it showcases the fact that, you know, tomato,
melon. How do you get it to look like that? How do you get the stripes, or is that in the glass?
I think actually the glass has that decoration on it.
Okay.
So that was easy, but something that, again, it could be sweet and served at the end of the meal. It could be savory. You could add jalapenos and make it really nice and hot. So it's very versatile. And then, clearly, the stroganoff's a big one, the lobster corn dog. We sell close to 20,000 of those over the weekend at the Lollapalooza Music Festival here.
Yeah, you run that, don't you? Tell us about Lollapalooza.
Yeah, so I oversee all the food there, from choosing what restaurants are going to be part of the lineup, and then cooking for the headlining act. So another thing that we decided to do was this year and into next year is put an education element. So there's Kidsapalooza, where it's music and face painting and dance for all the kids. But we said, why not kind of jump on the MasterChef Junior bandwagon and do something with, you know, farming and cooking and teaching and getting kids exposed to that, because again, that relationship, food and music are so close. So that's what we're looking to do now.
You have a section where you do beans. You love beans, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I told somebody, the guy who owns that Rancho Gordo, about the you know, this Sardinia's part of that blue zone where everybody lives over 100. They asked this old guy what was his reason for longevity, and he said beans.
Yeah. I just think that they're such a great source of protein, and they're so flavorful and versatile. You know, you can serve them on their own. You can overcook them and mash them or refry them or turn them into your own style of hummus. It doesn't have to be garbanzo. It could be lentil, white bean, you know, anything. So I think that they get a bad rap all the time because people just associate it, you know, with some of the side effects that it can give you sometimes.
That's
but
very delicately
is,
put.
Yeah, thank you. I was trying to politically, you know, make it sound classy. But I think that when you think of it, you know, if you call it a legume or something else, you know, it sounds nice and sexy. But, you know, you stew them, you cook them, you know, you can.
I love them, absolutely.
Yeah, you can do so much with them. They're great.
Yeah, and my standard breakfast is soft-boiled eggs, and Peter fixes me a mixture of sprouted lentils and mung beans and all other things.
Oh, it sounds delicious.
Yeah. So anyhow, you like carbs, but you point out that you have to be careful with them, and you yourself watch what you eat, which is another way I think you relate to the general public.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've fought with weight issues my whole life, and I think that, you know, food has always been the friend there that you can turn to, and you got to be careful with that, obviously, and realize that the chef, it's funny because so many of us will spend so much time finding incredible farmers and ingredients and preparing them for hours and serving people, and then we go in the back and eat, you know, little scraps at like 2 a.m, you know, before we go home. So you start thinking, well, how can I take care of myself if I have access to these things? So that you can only eat so much at any given time. What do you want to get out of it? What's the best way to maximize it? So you can have one dinner roll or like a 4 or 5 ounce beautiful piece of salmon.
Yeah,
things like that.
You seem to be catching on to this. I mean, I look at Joe Bastianich. I mean, I remember him before.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
Yeah. And there's a local chef here that he was really blowing up, you know, and he got that, what do you call it, it was the app that everybody uses,
yeah.
And he found out just in sampling the dishes going out, he was consuming an extra 2,200 calories
Wow.
And so he caught on to that, and he's trim now. But they also take up running, which, I mean, do you want to wreck your knees?
I know. That's the thing. I ran a marathon last year, and I was talking to my dad, and he was saying, you know, like, just be careful, because that's one thing that, you know, you can ride a bike and get, you know, just as much out of it, but it doesn't destroy your joints, and that's something that, you know, as you get older, you're going to really do a lot of this stuff, so be careful.
Right. Well, there's so many different things. You like truffled popcorn, and, you know, that's what Thomas Keller served with at the opening of Warner Center in New York.
Truffled
popcorn, yeah.
And I think
truffle.
It's fun. Because, you know, I don't want to serve just a bunch of bread, and then you fill up on that, and you don't order anything on the menu. And also, it kind of showcases that, you know, it's like theater. It's like the fun's about to start.
Right. Yes, it is. And here's the Graham Burger. How's that different? That's a...
You know, I think that for us...
You know, I don't think that that looks like... I mean, how many calories in that, Graham?
Oh, yeah. That's where I'm cooking for other people. I'm not sitting down eating like three of those things. It's you know, full of goodness, though. You've got your melty brie. It's almost like the fondue, you know, with grilled onion, some watercress. You know, it could be arugula if you wanted, garlic aioli. So I think it's flavors that go really well together, and it's nothing insane where you try to throw everything, you know, in the kitchen sink, you know, at it and try to stuff it. But it's just a nice solid burger.
It's not like DB Bistro's $49.95 burger. Stuffed with foie gras and short ribs.
No, I know. Yeah, Danielle kind of cornered that market, so I don't even want to go there.
There you go.
Well, anyhow, I enjoy this cookbook, and I enjoy you. You have a great sense of humor, and people always view you as a fun person, but you're really very serious about the food, cooking, and life, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I always try to remember that they say that, the world's been here 6 billion years, and I think that if we're lucky, you know, you maybe get to live to be 100, so it's just a tiny dot, you know, on the calendar that you're here, and you got to get the most out of it through life, music, art, comedy, food, all of those things.
Well, you're a delight, and so is your book. It's Graham Elliott, Cooking Like a Master Chef. And it's coming out as we speak.
Oh, and let's not forget, in case you find yourself in Chicago, Graham does have a restaurant in Chicago called
Graham Elliott Bistro. Yep.
And I have to say that after this conversation, I think you must perhaps be the most unusual 2-star Michelin chef I've ever met.
Yeah, I don't know how we get that kind of rating. You know, you just do what you do and hope for the best.
Great. Well, keep it up, and I'm sure they'll keep it up as well. And once again, let me echo what Anne said. It's been a pleasure listening to you have this conversation, and I hope our paths cross again very soon.
That would be great. Thank you so much, guys, for taking the time.
Thanks, Graham.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
And don't go away, because we'll be back right after the break with what is the real theme of this week's program, after having brought you this great interview with Graham.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Of course, Mexican food today is really hot, and I don't mean that to be punny. It's like books are arriving on our desk with the inside of Mexico, inside out in Mexico, the regional cuisines of Mexico, tacos, and now a whole book, the first of its kind, on enchiladas.
Well, hold on. I promised I would tell this listeners what the theme was of today's program. And it's about the fact that enchiladas and the track which is going to follow. See if you can guess. You can certainly probably guess that if we're talking about mass produced food that most people consider just rubbish fast food, which is pizza, is coming up. And I thought it was interesting that arriving recently in our mailbox were two books the one about enchiladas and the one about pizza, which really represent both enchiladas and pizza, not as fast food junk, but as really excellent, interesting food that will make a great addition to your culinary prowess and the mealtimes of your family. So enchiladas first, and then after that break, we'll be doing pizzas.
We're talking to Cappy Lawton from San Antonio, Texas, about his book, Enchiladas, Aztec to Tex-Mex, which is a big subject. And in fact, this book, it says, is the first book to solely focus on enchiladas, which you view as sort of a map of Mexican history.
That's true. I also want to mention, too, that co-wrote this book with a very good friend named Chris Waters Dunn.
Right.
And Chris wasn't available for our interview this afternoon, but I do want to mention that he was a very integral part of this book, as were many others. So.
Okay, so he's a guy, too. So we've got Cappy and Chris, and they're both guys.
That's correct.
Now, you have a fascinating and initially confusing background having to do with airplanes and engineering, and then a very interesting process whereby you determined that your future and your passion lay in the area of restaurants. Tell us that.
Well, it is curious. My father was in the aviation business. He actually owned an aircraft engine overhaul shop. So I was brought up on the tarmac at the airport. And when I was 14, I went to work for a family friend who started a company called Swearingen Aircraft. And that company grew from, I think I was the 50th employee to well over 1,500 employees, and was a pretty famous aircraft manufacturer. So I did that through high school years and some of college. And then I went to work for another family friend that designed and built interiors for Gulfstream jets and Bell Ranger helicopters.
My goodness.
And I did that through college and afterwards, and I studied engineering in college and business. But when I got out, I decided that I really didn't love aviation business as much as I should, and I wanted to find something to do that I had a real passion for. It was kind of not a very glamorous story, but I spent quite a bit of time, and I gave myself 90 days to research another business to get into. That was 42 years ago, and if someone told me when I started that process that I'd be in the restaurant business, I'd tell them they were crazy.
Me too.
But I ended up choosing that business, and I've never regretted it. It's been a lot of fun, and I've enjoyed my career a lot.
So you said you went to the library and got books out.
That's what I did. I didn't tell you anything.
I did. I'd spend half a day in the library and half a day each day, and very diligently, by the way, talking to people, primarily older people, and I was very curious about what life would be like to them if they lived it over again, what they saw the future holding, and also what businesses prospered in the Depression. And I was very curious at the uniformity of the answers, because almost all of them told me the same thing. They said that during the Depression, that beauty parlors, cinemas, movies, as we would describe them today, and cafes, which I think the broader term these days is restaurants. And I thought that was kind of fascinating answer to a question about very, very hard times.
I'm rather surprised, actually, because I would think that would be one of the earliest things to go.
Well, you would think so, but according to their answers, and this was quite a number of people, those were the three most uniform answers. And that, for many other reasons, I chose to open a very small college pub next to a junior college, a community college that I had gone to in San Antonio. Luckily, it was successful, and I built a number of restaurants all around the state of Texas, and not all of which were successful, but luckily the first few were, and I sold almost all of them, but we still own three restaurants in San Antonio. And
now, the one is historic, actually, La Fonda on Main, right?
That's correct.
And you had an interesting quandary there about how to bring it back to authentic from its Tex-Mex clientele.
Well, I wouldn't say back to, because it never was. It was
right.
Tex-Mex always. San Antonio is interesting. I love living here. I've lived here my entire life. It's today it's about 67% Hispanic, and
that's
so I describe
right.
it often to people as being as much in northern Mexico as it is southern United States.
That's true.
And there are roughly 5,000 restaurants, and roughly 1,000 of those are what would be described as Mexican restaurants. But the truth is, almost all of them were Tex-Mex restaurants.
Right.
And at this stage of my life, I had traveled a lot through Mexico since my early 20s. And I learned to be fascinated with the food from interior Mexico, which very little could be found in San Antonio. And people, in my opinion, kind of misunderstood what real true Mexican food was. And so that's why we bought the restaurant 19 years ago. That restaurant today is 83 years old.
Wow.
And it was very difficult to introduce interior Mexican cuisine. It was already a very, very well-established restaurant, and people had certain expectations. And so when they came in and found things, for example, a lot of seafood dishes, they said, why in the world would you have a Mexican restaurant with seafood? And I said, have you ever looked at Mexico? It has a tremendous coastline, which unfortunately right now today is getting hammered. So.
Oh, it's hitting, isn't it? I want to say that your explanation of why you wrote this whole book on enchiladas resonates with us. It really is the history of Mexico on a plate, in a sense. The culture of Mexico on a plate as well. I mean, I can't tell you how many things I learned from reading this book that had nothing to do with actually making enchiladas.
Well, Chris and I wanted very much for it to be far more than just a book of recipes.
Oh, you have so much information in this book. I was just floored by the stuff that I learned that I never heard of before.
Well, I always tell pretty people that I'm pretty convinced that I was Mexican in my last life, and I have great, great respect for Mexico and the food of Mexico and the history of Mexico. It has a fascinating and somewhat tumultuous and tough history, certainly part of it that it's facing right now.
Oh, I know, yes.
But it's a great country with great, great people. And someone explained to me years ago that Italy, for example, really doesn't have a cuisine, that it was a very geographically diverse country with 27 warring city-states.
Oh, yeah, it wasn't a unified nation until
the 19th century.
Late 1800s.
Late 19th century, yes.
19-something.
Yeah, 1876, if I remember right. But anyway, Mexico, in a lot of ways, had a similar history because most people don't realize that it has two major mountain ranges going right down the middle of it.
Yeah.
It has a huge amount of coastline. It has a lot of geographic diversity, a lot of economic diversity, and I don't know exactly, but more than 60% of the people that live in Mexico are in one city, Mexico City.
Oh, yeah. That's outrageous, that city is, really. I mean,
outrageously beautiful and outrageously overpopulated.
Really impossible to deal with, yeah.
Yeah, but beautiful place. So I found as I traveled through it, and when I was younger, a friend and I had an airplane, and we flew all over Mexico and got to visit a lot of small towns all over the country. As I got older, my wife and I visited Mexico a lot, several times per year. And every time we would go to someplace different, I was just so impressed with the fact that, for example, almost every town, city, geographic region had an enchilada, but they were all very diverse and very much indigenous to the area, to the food that was available, to the seasonality, and to the culture in the background. And we just thought it, Chris and I both thought it would make a fascinating story using the enchilada as the sort of iconic figure of each of these areas.
Well, this is true. Now, I mean, you take us, walk us through things like chilies, telling me things about chilies that I never knew before, like that the heat isn't really in the seeds, it's in the membrane.
It's really in the membrane, according to all the studies.
Yeah, that's funny, because I've always known it was in the seeds. But you trace the history of all these ingredients, too. You have the chilies, avocados. I want to point out that basically for your point of reference, enchiladas are made only with corn tortillas, no flour tortillas. Why is that?
Well, until recently it would be very difficult to find a flour tortilla in all of Mexico.
Uh-huh.
First place, wheat is not grown in Mexico. It
perhaps pockets of it, but it's not a product of Mexico. And so corn is. Corn originated in Mexico, was first hybridized thousands of years ago in Mexico, and it certainly was the food of the Aztecs, the Mayans, all the indigenous people of Mexico. And there's several sayings in Spanish, but one of them is, sin maíz, sin país, which means without corn, there would be no country.
Yes.
And there's also the saying that if the presidents of Mexico can almost do anything and they want, but if they ever try to raise the price of corn or tortillas, that they'll get thrown out of office in major revolution. And so it is truly the food of Mexico. And the natural thing when you have a tortilla, a corn tortilla, is to put things in it or on it or sauce it and roll it up. And so the word enchilada really means, Chris likes to use the word chilify, means to...
Yeah, that's a funny word.
It's if you chilify a tortilla, then it becomes an enchilada. And so we do not have any... that's not to say one couldn't make an enchilada with a flour tortilla. You could certainly do that, but no one in Mexico would call it an enchilada. So
you take us through all the ingredients, interesting things on chiles. I didn't realize that that corn smata was that common. I mean, so important. Why is it not valued in the U.S.?
Well, that's a great question. I remember the first time that I had it. They call it huitlacoche in Mexico,
huitlacoche.
Or cuitlacoche. Some people use the C and some people just H. It's certainly a pre-Columbian food. It was, the Aztecs ate it a lot extensively and prized it, as do all Mexicans these days. It's literally a fungus or a mushroom which grows on the corn itself. When I first found out about it, I came back to San Antonio and I looked all over, and we have a whole bunch of farmers in the neighborhood, and went out and asked them, does anybody grow huitlacoche? And they had no idea what I was talking about, but when I described it to them, they say, oh yeah, if that happens, we burn our fields.
Oh, how awful.
And so, interestingly enough, when you got it here and used it, it came in a can, and like everything in a can, it lost a lot of its flavor.
Yeah, I've never had it. I mean, I've spent a lot of time in Central America, but I never had huitlacoche.
About 15 years ago, I found out there was a guy in Florida who had decided to actually grow it. And when I first spoke to him, he was having a tough time finding anybody to buy it. And now, if you call him, you have to make reservations on the product 3 and 4 months in advance because he's sold out of it.
Really? So it's coming into its own or what?
I believe so. I believe that there's more and more people that appreciate it, like it, and certainly that he is appealed to.
Well, I hope I get the chance to taste it. You have a lot of information on avocados, which are also, they're at a high point today too, aren't they? Globally, not just here, and not just in traditional areas of appreciation. But all over the world, avocados. You go to London and get avocados in restaurants.
Well, my wife Susie and I love to travel. And it's been fascinating in the last 10 years because almost everywhere we go, Mexican food is on the rise. And recently we were in London, Paris, and Prague. In all of those places, there were significant Mexican restaurants that were grown in popularity. And avocados are certainly a core part of the cuisine of Mexico. They now, a lot of people call them the gold of Mexico. And I hate to say a negative thing, but evidently they've gotten so valuable that evidently the drug lords have decided it's a great investment opportunity. So I hope they don't become a Mexican mafia commodity. But
Well, Peter's cousin grows organic avocados in Tasmania in Australia.
Oh, really? That's great.
He has a microclimate.
But he got a lot of advice from the Agriculture Department of the University of Mexico in Mexico City. So he was in touch with them a lot, getting tips from them as to how to go about growing his crop. I think he says he certainly wouldn't have succeeded at all if they hadn't been very generous in giving him the advice that he needed.
Well, I'm certain that he would know about it, Peter, but if not, tell him that probably the most delicious avocado is one you never see in the United States, but it's called avocado aguacate criollo. It's a Creole avocado, and it's a small black avocado that you literally eat the skin and everything. It's
really?
Black.
Oh, wow.
The skin is very thin, and you eat the skin and everything, and the avocado taste is as much like butter as it does avocado.
They're Where
absolutely
do you get that?
Delicious.
Where do you get it?
You can get them in central Mexico and south of there. You don't see them in northern Mexico very often. And that is also usually the leaf that you use in cooking comes from that kind of avocado.
So, but moving on, I mean, you tell us how to make cheese, you talk about, I never even thought about the importance of salt in Mexican cuisine, but you have a whole history of that culturally, too, and why it's important. And I thought that your herbs and spices section was very informative. I actually never did understand, although Rick Bayless has gone on about Mexican oregano ad nauseum, I never realized it was totally different from Italian oregano, although it's the same plant, huh?
Yes, the flavor is significantly different. It'd be closer to margarine.
You know, you've had recipes using margarine. I think that's odd.
Well, I'm not sure because a lot of times herbs taste different in different parts of the country, but marjoram tastes more like Mexican oregano. They're not the same, but it's a better substitute than Italian oregano.
Uh-huh. And then, of course, you have a whole spread on cilantro, which I guess you either love that or you hate it.
Well, there's evidence that there are certain people that literally, when they eat it, that it tastes to them like turpentine.
Yeah, it's built into their genes. It's a genetic
exactly.
thing.
Exactly. Yeah, and it's they're repulsed from it. But luckily, I'm not one of those, and I love cilantro. I'm sort of like that with cumin. To me, cumin is way too strong and overpowers everything. In our restaurants, it's hard to get my chefs to back off sometimes from using it. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know what to say more about this book. You have obviously detailed instructions on how to make your tortillas from scratch. And you have a huge variety of fillings and sauces and how to prepare these in your book, too, for the tortillas. But then you also have sides and just about everything you'd want to know with a very low-keyed explanation, clear and low-keyed explanation of it. I mean, I think this is a treasure.
Well, thank you very, very much. I appreciate that. Well, one thing I might share is we have a website called enchiladasbook.com.
Okay.
And we did a couple of really fun videos. One of them, I think one of the most fun things, if you get interested in Mexican food, is to make your own tortillas. And we have a video on exactly how to make tortillas. And at first, it's a little foreboding, I guess, or whatever, but I've gotten to where I can make, 50 tortillas in 10 or 15 minutes. And so it's something that you get better and better and better at doing. And making your own tortillas is a lot of fun. You can do a lot of things with them. You can put things into them. But they're definitely better than anything that you can buy.
Oh, yes, indeed.
And so if anyone wants to know more about our book, enchiladasbook.com is a good place to go see these videos.
And we'll list that on the website, too, so that people will be able to have it right at their fingertips.
Thank you. And if you're in San Antonio, we have a wonderful restaurant called La Fonda on Main.
Yes.
And we serve these enchiladas all the time. And, in fact, our chefs now are doing a special one every single week out of the book.
Oh, nice. Very nice touch, yeah. Oh, yeah. Did you get the spelling of those avocados yet?
I think it's, I should.
You can just email us, probably.
I think I best email it to you. I'm going to go research it. But it's the Spanish word for Creole.
Okay.
And it's,
Creole, it has a double L.
Creole, I believe, only has one L in French.
Oh. Well,
Creole,
I know.
But I'm not positive.
No,
but
the Spanish, I think, has two.
This phonetically is Criollo.
Yeah.
Criollo.
Yeah. Okay.
And so I'll have to look up the, I think it's C-R-I-O-L-L-O, Criollo.
Right. Well, that's some good to know. I said you're full of all this information, Kathy.
Thank you.
Nepalis, I know how to make all kinds of stuff.
Yes, Nepalis are great, too, and they're finding more and more that they're very, very beneficial for you, particularly for people with diabetes. So.
Right. Well, as I said, you have a bunch of information. I love talking to you, and hopefully we'll meet up in San Antonio.
Well, Ann and Peter, thank you very much for your interest, and if you head our way, give us a call.
Kathy, adios.
Adios.
What should we say, sweetheart? This man sure knows his enchiladas.
I should say.
So if you're down south of the border, north of the border, down San Antonio way, you know where to go to check it out.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay, sweetheart, so we're moving on from a man who knows his enchiladas to a man who knows his
pizza. I love pizza, and so I was really looking forward to this new book from Ritalie, The United States of Pizza, by Craig Prevey and my old friend Diane Jacob. We're going to be talking to Craig. Craig, I was salivating throughout this book.
The pictures will do that to you.
Yes.
They're gorgeous, and the pizzas, I mean, the crust, I think, just pops right off the page on every pizza.
It does, and crumbs. You've got crumbs in the face.
Yeah, like we were eating when we wrote this book. Well, we actually were absolutely fun.
Uh-huh. So
yeah, it's filled with amazing photos.
It's subtitled, America's Favorite Pizzas, From Thin Crusted to Deep Dish, Sourdough to
Gluten-Free,
which is a whole new concept. But how you organize this book was according to the dough, which makes a lot of sense. Tell us
Thank
about
you.
That.
Well, there were several ways to think about this book. I've been working on this book for about 5 years.
And you wrote one before this.
Yeah, my other book came out in 2008. And then, I worked on that book, promoting it, until about 2010 or so. And I still did after that. But around 2010 is when I started becoming... writing down these ideas that I saw across the country, and I wanted to organize them at first regionally, I thought, because, this is a book about regional styles of pizza. But then it came, like, a little bit after trying that organization for the book, I wasn't sure that I liked it, and we wanted to make it a more food-driven chapter. Everything will be like dough driven, and dough is the most important part of the pizza. And then I found out, all these pizzas from around the region will just fit in the proper dough chapter. And there's about eight different doughs, eight or nine. I think right now this book has whole wheat, New York, Naples, stuffed pizza dough, Sicilian pizza dough, corn flour, sourdough, and gluten free. And in the corn flour, I include a blue corn flour and a yellow corn flour.
Uh-huh.
So it's just really exciting to see all of the regional doughs across the, what you see and how they turn it into a different pizza all the way across the nation.
Well, you have so many different types of pizzas here, so many different recipes. What is your basic definition of a pizza?
A basic pizza has to have a crust with some kind of topping or flavoring on it.
That fits all kinds of flatbreads or anything across the world.
I think they're all very related to pizza. A lot of your flatbreads is pizza. So I think, the Greeks, about 1500, they put just herbs and oil on something that they called a placenta. That turned into, that's a modern pizza. 100 years later in Rome, they took that idea and they started making a little more tomato sauce on it and became pizza. I think anything with a crust and, like, fillings or toppings can be called pizza.
Yeah, but your crust is really different one to the next.
Yes, there's so many different forms. That's what's so cool about pizza. It's like it takes so many forms, but it's still pizza. And this regionally across the United States, you see the agricultures of the places affecting the pizzas. You see the type of people that or their culture informs these pizzas. And you see these waves of pizzas throughout the country. If you go across the country looking at each region, you see why they're making these pizzas, and you discover new pizzas that you didn't even know existed, and they may not look like a pizza you could think, like, that's a pizza, but it's still pizza. Like the pierogi pizza in Pennsylvania, that's a very Pennsylvania Dutch area. They have this beautiful stuffed crust just filled with mashed potatoes and cheese. Yeah. And, you know, it doesn't look like a pizza to me, really, but it is pizza. And so it's cool that pizza takes so many forms.
But according to your definition, a stromboli is a pizza.
Oh, it is. I believe it's a pizza that somebody just rolled up. Wouldn't you say, in fact, they have stromboli in the book, and they have some other types of stromboli, like there's a lot of stuffed pies that are large like a disc, but they still have a top crust and a bottom crust. And a stromboli is a pizza. All it is the stuff on a pizza or maybe some steak rolled in the pizza dough. The guy who was credited for, well, he took credit for making the first stromboli, and that information is in the book. He was like a pizza maker that rolled his pizza up like a cigar, and then it worked. It was a pizza. It was made by a pizza pizzeria.
Uh-huh.
That makes it pizza.
Uh-huh.
There you go. He's in an interesting location, just around the corner from the Philadelphia International Airport.
It's okay. You know, yeah.
I know.
That's in the book.
I found Essington, Pennsylvania, by mistake one day, trying to find a back way to the airport, and finished up totally.
I just had a lot of fun at the airport myself.
I finished up totally lost.
So, what are we going to talk about? Let's talk more about pizza.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that it would be interesting if you picked out some, because there's so many options here, if you picked out some of your favorites and talked about them.
Sure. Really, I absolutely love this hot brown pizza. That pizza is incredible. It has a Mornay sauce, which is like Alfredo, like a white cream sauce, but you add Gruyere cheese to it. And it's nice, rich, and silky. And then you have slices of roast turkey and bacon, you know, crumbled, and fresh tomatoes on top. The tomatoes, I like to put them onto the hot pizza, and you get this really nice, you know, it's like a fresh bite when you get a tomato, and it's chilled, uh-huh. And you have the bacon, the Swiss cheese, and the turkey. Goes right back to the old Brown Hotel where they invented the hot brown sandwich. It's in the Derby Town, you know, in Louisville.
Yeah, we were talking about that just before we came on
the air. It's just such a popular pizza. I've served it, and I've shown it to many people, and it's always a favorite. And I love that one. I also love the deep dish Reuben pie. And that's one I've made on a couple news programs. Because it's a real simple thing, but it's so impressive looking. It's like a 14-inch disc. It's a deep dish crust, and it's filled with corned beef with sauerkraut and Swiss cheese and Thousand Island dressing. And on top is a nice crispy crust, and you cut this into wedges, and it's just like eating a Reuben sandwich, only it's deep dish pizza. And I just think it's a simple thing, and when you see it on your table, it's super impressive. But it's easy to make, you know, and I think pizza shouldn't be complicated. Just have to have a few techniques.
Now, we were talking before we came on the air about Chicago, I guess, considered by many people, including yourself, as the home of deep dish pizza, and not the ultimate, but certainly perhaps the best known deep dish pizza is from Uno Pizzeria, not too far off Michigan Avenue on the north side in Chicago. But how did you get them to give you the recipe?
Oh, you're mistaken. These are not their recipes.
Oh, these are not their recipes. Oh, okay.
I've created these recipes emulating everyone's pizzas across the nation. See, these recipes have been written by me. I haven't been given recipes.
Peter and I were just debating about that. He said these are real recipes. And I said, what do you mean by that? And he said they're actually the recipes of the restaurants. And I said, no.
No, they're not.
No. Okay. There are more. I think in many cases they're much better. And that's because what I've done as a chef, I've taken the essence of these pizzas and I've just jacked it up a bit and made it the way I just felt that my recipes or my talent for writing recipes is pretty good, to be honest with you. And I really felt as though I did all the pizzas across the nation great justice. And the recipes are simple, too, and partially because Diane Jacob has helped make them very simple as well. She's very, you know, good at streamlining things and making sure things stay in order.
Yeah, so my old friend Diane. Hello, Diane, wherever you are.
Well, now, hello, Diane.
Well, now, hold on a second. I just realized that we have the chef from Pizzeria Bianco in Phoenix, Arizona. He's on the other line.
No way. Is he really?
Let's see who else is. And then I have another line to Osteria in Philadelphia.
You do?
Oh, yeah. I'm right on the other line.
I'm so excited. That's amazing. Are we going to talk?
They're coming around to your house afterwards.
What do they want to do?
That's a good question.
They want to come over and give me a pizza? Are you joking with me?
You know,
I love those guys. I saw Chris Bianco at some seminar that he taught. He's such a artisan. He's an amazing, sort of eclectic, eccentric kind of amazing genius for pizza.
You know, we just saw him at the Nashville Music City Food and Wine, and he had a booth there, and he had no pizza at all. But we interviewed him anyhow. You can look on our audio archives and find him in the National interviews.
Yeah, he's a cool guy. And Varsano is in Atlanta, so he's done really well with his sort of upgrade pizza restaurant. It's beautiful. It's a fine dining restaurant.
Now we were surprised and a little bit shocked about a couple of your pizzas.
Okay, was that? Can we talk about it?
Sure. I guess the one that had the corn kernels on it was kind of interesting.
Isn't that
was
cool?
Kind of
and it has balsamic onions. It has a soft corn flour crust. It's delicious pizza. You know what's really special about that is you get a nice sweet and tangy and buttery salty bite. You know, I have it on the tip of my tongue here. But it is definitely from a place that pizza is called Corn Pizza. it's exciting because all their pizzas are made like corn pizza or fig pizza or sausage pizza. Here it is, Zalo Gourmet Crust in Arcadia, California. And those chefs are purists. They like to take one idea and make a pizza from it and just showcase that ingredient. I think that's exciting. That's why I included them.
Now, we did. We had more of a shock when we found a pizza with pineapple in it, because pineapple...
That's not that shocking.
In England, they call American pizza. It's called Pizza Americana or something. They call it, and it has pineapple on it. And when the first time I had it, which was years ago, I said, I'm American. I never had pizza with pineapple on it.
Well, it's kind of an American... tradition.
Well,
I don't know if anybody
Hawaiian
else.
Maybe. I don't country. Know.
There's definitely a lot of regional differences in traditions as far as pizza, and I think pineapple is one of them because I don't think anybody else put it on pizza. Certainly wouldn't see that in Italy. They would never dream about putting.
In Italy, anyhow.
It's America where we're just freewheeling and do whatever we want with pizza, and that's what makes it so fun. We love to feed our families. We're not just when we order pizza. Like if you order it in Europe or in Italy, you'll get one and it's your pizza. But in America, we made it. Everybody's included. It's a party. It's a family dish. It's a pizza. When you get one, you get it for everybody, and everybody eats it. And this brings people together. And America is the first kind of country that really took pizza and started eating it like that, turned it into a national pastime.
And I have one last question here. Some of these pizzas look kind of difficult to eat, including this whole meatball pizza on the cover.
That's delicious. It has a sweet Cincinnati red sauce with pork meatballs and chili peppers.
Yeah, but my question is, in terms of the actual function of eating it, what do you think of people...
Well, I usually just pick it up, put it in my mouth.
What do you think of people who use a knife and a fork to eat pizza?
It depends what kind of pizza it is. You have to eat a deep dish pizza with a knife and a fork.
Okay.
There's no way around it. And you certainly can't pick it up. It's too much, too wet, and too much, too hot. So it depends what the pizza is, you know. And it also depends where you're eating it, I would say, how you're going to eat that pizza. But either way, it's just good to be eating pizza.
Well, listeners, if you want pizza to go where you never even thought it would, such as dark wing duck pizza or crab pizza, or if you just want the straight old traditional margarita pizza, this is the book for you. It's called The United States of Pizza by Craig Priebe with Diane Jacob. Craig, thanks for talking to us.
Oh, it was a blast. Nice to talk with you. We'll see you again sometime, Ann and Peter. Thank you so much for having me on.
You're welcome, and thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So perhaps you can guess what's going to be on the menu's dinner table tonight, or maybe their lunch table tomorrow, because Miss Ann's a huge pizza enthusiast, and now she has a whole lot more to be enthusiastic about.
I do.
But once again, we hope that we'll see you same time, same place next week. And in the meantime, cook enchiladas, eat pizza.
And bye-bye.
Okay.